Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
This is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, and I'm in the webcast version. And with me in the studio, actually via Skype, is Dr. Roy Cantrell. He's a global breeding outreach and partnership lead at Monsanto Company. Thanks once again for being here, Roy.
How do you do?
So, we already talked a little bit about what you do, but I want to know more about it because I'm fascinated by how a person gets to the point at which you've gotten. So talk a little bit about your own training, how you got on the path to be a crop scientist and ended up sort of where you were.
Well, I mean, fortunately, I grew up on a farm, a small family farm in the Texas Panhandle, so I've always been involved in agriculture. As I went off to my undergraduate degree to get a BAS, I was interested in the scientific aspect. Had the real fortune while I was an undergrad to actually get a part-time job at a seed company. And from the very start, the genetics, the breeding, the crop aspect of it really fascinated me. I remembered my farming experience. And pretty quickly, I knew I wanted to be a plant scientist or a breeder, someone that really focuses on plants and try to improve those plants using genetics. So I took all the genetic courses I could, knew that I had to get a graduate degree, so I went to the University of Minnesota after completing my BS in Texas and got a master's and PhD in plant genetics. So I've been a plant breeder for about 35 years, and I've really seen the transformation of plant breeding. And all the science that's being applied to plant breeding, whether molecular sciences, genome sequencing, DNA markers, data sciences today. So it's been a fabulous time to work in plant breeding and plant improvement.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more. So back when you first started, you couldn't insert genes into the genome of these plants. And so what did you do? Basically crossbreed things just for outcome? Is that what basically happened?
That's correct. I mean, we made crosses. We tried to introduce specific traits that are naturally in the plant that you're working in. I've worked in grain sorghum, corn, wheat, and as well as cotton. Many traits that you see in plants, those are inherited and passed on as genes, just like traits that people are familiar with in humans, like hair color or body size or skin color or whatever. So we can move those traits by regular breeding. We can understand them statistically and analyze them. You have a lot of parent information, pedigree information. So all the way back to Mendel with his peas, I mean, there's a lot of genetics that a body of knowledge that we can use even before we were able to use biotechnology. And the tools had just been refined to where we are today.
Absolutely. So now you were in academics for quite a while, is that right?
That's right.
So talk a little bit about the difference between being an academic scientist and working for Monsanto.
Sure. I was in academia for about 20 years. I had a tenured professor position right out of grad school once I received my PhD. So I taught genetics, taught plant breeding, had graduate students for MS, PhDs, and postdocs. You know, the focus was training students. The focus was scientific publication. I have over 75 scientific publications. I've written 5 or so book chapters on aspects of plant genetics and wheat and cotton over the years. I mean, I really enjoyed my time in academia. About 8 years ago, Monsanto approached me, and they were starting some new research programs in cotton and other crops here at Monsanto. And I wasn't really ready to leave academia. But when I came to St. Louis, and I guess as a plant geneticist, seeing the tools that I would get to use, there's really two things that made it different, and I think attracted me to Monsanto. One was just the tools that I would get to use in plant genetics and breeding, DNA markers, genomic sequence information, and the power of those tools really attracted me. The second part that I think was just as important was the global aspect of it. I'm very interested in international agriculture. I had obviously some exposure in academia. You have foreign graduate students. You have possibly grants that involve collaboration with an international partner in Africa or China or wherever. But really, once you get into a global company like Monsanto, agriculture is, there's not a day goes by that I don't work with colleagues in another country and have the ability to improve crops for farmers, just like the farm I grew up on, but it's in Africa or India or wherever. So those are the two things that really made it different for me. The transition was very easy. I sometimes miss students. I don't miss grading papers. You can relate to that.
I've got a bunch to grade right now.
That's right. I can't help you with that. But, there's a lot of similarities. I think people over-exaggerate the differences. But I think I've identified the two things that really attracted me to Monsanto. And it's exceeded my expectations, particularly the global aspect of it. I mean, just the things that are going on globally. I worked in a lot of third world countries, such as Africa. The biological scientific problems we face, you don't see those, thankfully, in Iowa or Illinois, right? And so that's what keeps me going. That's what motivates me.
Let's talk about a technical thing now. So if you were to do, and this is just a question off the top of my head, to be totally honest, let's say you were to cross just regular crosses that you might do for a while, and then instead you were to do some gene sequence insertion. Could somebody come in and easily be able to tell after the fact whether it was an insertion of a gene or whether via standard crossing techniques the genome was modified? Is that easy to detect the difference, or is it actually almost impossible to tell the difference?
In most cases, it's easy to detect the difference because typically with the biotech trait that's been inserted, you're expressing a novel trait, something that the plant doesn't normally do. You're making a cotton plant highly resistant to a worm pest that those genes don't exist anywhere in the cotton genome or wild relatives or anything else. You may be making it genetically resistant to a herbicide. So really you're doing something above and beyond what can be done through a regular breeding.
So let's talk about the cotton then. So how do you identify, for BT cotton, let's say specifically, how do you find the gene that you need in order to be resistant to the particular worm that you want it to be resistant to? Where does that gene come from?
I think it first starts with understanding the target pest, right? And everything we know scientifically about the worm pest. Monsanto has a large library as well as collaborations with compounds that naturally occurring compounds like BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, produces. It's a bacteria in the soil that produces a crystalline protein that, when ingested by a certain target pest, actually kills that insect. So it's like searching through books in a library. We have many in the early days of developing BT crops or insect resistance crops from biotechnology. You came up with through screening, and a lot of these are done in artificial diets for the insect. You have the protein, and you augment the diet in a lab with that protein even before you think of putting it in the plant, right? So you have the protein, you can purify it, you can put it in assays and let the pest feed on it, measure their longevity, effect on reproduction on the insect. Once you identify a protein that is effective against the pest, then you can work on creating the necessary vectors, necessary means to put it into the cotton genome, and then it behaves just like a cotton gene. Okay. It gets passed on to its progeny.
Right, so let's talk about that a little bit. That ties into this whole idea of deciding on goals. So do you have a scientist somewhere who's just interested in this particular worm and is studying it, or do you get input because farmers and other people know, gee, this particular pest is a problem, and therefore you make a global decision, we're going to try to find a way to defeat the pest. And so it becomes a goal-oriented thing from the beginning, because I could easily see in physics where people find a solution to a problem that just happened to be worked on by somebody else without intent, whereas it sounds like you have intent early on in the process. So could you talk a little bit about whether you...
I think it starts with the farmer and the ecosystem, the growing conditions that the farmers face. So we're only going to work on problems and pests that we identify in the field. As an agricultural company, we're very close to our customers. We have agronomists, we have entomologists, we get feedback, we bring in farmers from all over the world, and we have advisory committees in terms of gathering feedback from growers on things we're working on. So I think we could do a lot, but it doesn't matter unless we're developing products that target a problem that the farmer has. So it really starts with the demand from the customer, which is the farmer, right? There's emerging insect pests that can be controlled, that can be impacted by new technology, and that's where we focus our technology. Another example, just beyond biotechnology, the growers have many decisions to make in the U.S., for instance, during the growing season, 50 more decisions, time to plant, what hybrid to plant, fertility, all the plant population, planting density of the crop, you know, not only in terms of developing the seed and a potential group of traits to help the farmer, we're the last couple of years heavily involved in data science so that we can help the farmer answer the questions that he has on his farm. What should be the plant population on this particular soil type and whatever. So those growers are asking that of us. It's not something we just decided to do. Growers come to us constantly and say, help me put this genetics that you developed on, tell me how it's going to do on my farm and where I should plant it and how I should manage it.
So let's talk about GMO. So this falls on, a lot of this falls under the category of GMO, so let's just discuss it in the sense that if there were, and sometimes people feel like, and we'll talk more about sociological reasons for people's feelings about GMO, but let's say there was an unforeseen consequence of whatever type. Is there a possibility, if there's an unforeseen consequence, that you can backtrack on that and modify it in some way so that that consequence goes away? Or is it that you're going to always get the consequences with the positives and there's no way to tease those out?
No, I think there is a way to tease that out and modify. We constantly are monitoring. The regulatory agencies require that of us. I'll give you an example. Weed species that have been in the past targeted by glyphosate, and the crops have been resistant to glyphosate, just like antibiotic resistance bacteria, those weeds have developed genetic resistance to the herbicide that we apply. So it no longer works on the weed that it did control in the past. That's not because of GMOs, but I think that is something that occurs along with growing GMOs. So the way we backtrack to address that problem is coming up with very complex, multiple modes of action for herbicide resistance. So it's not a single, we're developing cotton varieties today that farmers will grow in the U.S. next summer in 2016, where they have the choice of three totally different modes of action or herbicides that they can use. In the past, it's only been one or at most two. So it's more durable, and at the same time, we're already looking ahead 5 years, 10 years of what will be the next traits that we have to put in. So, you know, that's an example of backtracking and really getting at the source of what will be ahead of a potential problem that's accompanied, not caused by being GMO, but actually is accompanying the growing of GMO crops.
Well, I mean, the analogy a little bit with the whole bacteria antibiotic model seems to apply at some level, because that's been essentially the way that that people,
that's right,
doctors have been chasing that down for the last, well, since the invention, I suppose, of penicillin. Let's talk a little bit about the perception then. So GMO is essentially you modify the organism. It allows different kinds of tack to be taken. You constantly are trying to look at feedback loops so that you can look at other possible ways to attack this, like you just said, three different ways as opposed to one different way or one way. So now the sociological implications are that people can sometimes get on to things like an acronym like GMO that means something to people devoid of any of the scientific content. So how much of that is just I won't call it fear-mongering, but how much of that is just people that aren't completely aware of the science versus how much of it is real true worry that isn't misplaced?
Well, I think it starts with a true concern about the safety of the food. Are people wanting to know where their food came from, to be able to know more about their food, maybe than they did 10 or 15 years ago? So I think there is a component that quickly goes from wanting to know to I have access to information in social media about this that may not be technically valid or scientifically valid. And with what is faced now on just the flood of information in social media and the belief that everything you read is true, it starts is a small fear can become a big fear in minutes, right? Of seeing things on social media, particularly if it was a friend that told you that. So, and people have many friends on social media. So I think it's a combination of the lack of technical information. It is complex. People have less and less understanding of agriculture, such a small portion of the U.S. population has any connection at all with agriculture. People associate with food, but they don't make the association with the farmer unless it's maybe a farmer's market or farm to fork. They actually knew the farmer, but for a box of Cheerios or whatever, you don't really connect that back to a corn farmer in Iowa.
Right. And so, do you guys have a group of people associated with your team, or is it a broader Monsanto group that's trying to do public education and trying to address concerns? Let's suppose there was a true concern from, let's say, a farmer group. How do they go about handling that? Do they go to you, or do they go to Monsanto in general? How does feedback get?
I think we have a large group within Monsanto that really engage our customers, that engage society in general, even people that criticize us or have concerns about us. We, over the past couple of years, acknowledge that, you know, maybe 5 years ago and so, we didn't do that well, and that maybe contributed to some of the misunderstanding. But I think Monsanto is a lot more transparent today, and there's what is GMO answers on our website, web presence, addressing groups that typically we didn't engage before. Of course, our customers through our commercial organization engage us, but I think in the last couple of years, Monsanto has gone to great lengths, our executives, myself, many people within the company, engage in outreach. It's what I do now, and as a global breeding leader, People have questions about breeding. They have questions about biotechnology globally. I'm more than happy to engage them in any form at all.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the new efforts you have? I read something about a maize for Africa kind of a thing. So can you talk a little bit about something like that?
Yeah. We have a global plant breeding research program that starting about 5 to 6 years ago addressed water-efficient maize in Africa, Kenya, East African countries that really combines the best technology with partners such as Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, USAID, Buffett, other NGOs, to be African research agencies. It's a broad partnership with the target of improving maize for Africa. It involves both conventional breeding as well as biotech traits that make the corn plant more drought resistant. Several milestones were just reached just this last year. Multiple hybrids have been put in the hands of thousands of farmers in East Africa, and those farmers, the feedback that is given is that it's this technology has doubled their yields with these smallholder farmers. So it's a very successful program. It's one that's groundbreaking in terms of Africa crop production. It's some that's being that I think in the future can be replicated in other crops. It shows the power of partnerships. I mean, Monsanto is just one member of that partnership, in addition to NGOs and researchers on the ground in Africa. And with climate change, with the need to develop climate-resilient crops, I think it's a very, very timely research program.
Let's talk a little bit about the last thing that we will discuss, which is the bottom line. So Monsanto is a for-profit company, and absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's what the United States is based on. So do you ever encounter things, let's say interesting things that you would work on, but you can't because the bottom line isn't there? And that's not a criticism as much as just an observation. Have you ever seen something you thought was really interesting, but it just isn't going to play out because the market isn't there or something like that?
I think we encountered that scenario all the time. There's a lot more projects we would want to work on than we actually can work on. So being in technology, we're part of teams across the company that really are driven by the business and portfolio managers within the company, that we go through a pretty structured internal portfolio process that looks at first the feasibility of that research project. How much is it going to cost in R&D to develop that? What's the benefit that the company would receive from developing that product. So Monsanto has a very rigorous process that stretches out for really 10 years or more of a potential research area, and very often going through that process, we will stop the project, shelve one, or never start a project because it doesn't meet that threshold. It may cost too much, R&D. The probability of success may be too low. The ability to capture value, to share value with our customer, may not be there for that particular product. So as a business, I think globally, Monsanto, in every region we're located in the country, has that process well established, and we spend months on that. Being a scientist in plant breeding, we're members of that team, and we provide the technical guidance, but there's people in the business that's really all they do is manage the portfolio.
So can you talk a little bit about, you came from a farm when you grew up, you've been involved with plant breeding for a long time. So if you were to assess the benefit of GMO over the last 30 years, let's say, versus any negative consequences, of which there are some, you would call it a win so far. Is that right? I mean, would you call it a dominant win right now?
I would call it a dominant win. This is a significant year, 2015. This is the 20th anniversary of the commercialization of the first biotech crops, cotton and soybeans. And over those 20 years, there's been significant benefit to society and farmers. For instance, billions of dollars have returned to the cotton grower in from many countries. If you add across all countries, over $40 billion over those 20 years that's benefit to cotton farmers in the countries where BT cotton is commercialized. That's due to increased yields and decreased cost for applying pesticides. The environmental cost or the environmental benefit, you've reduced over that 20-year period pesticide applications by over 25%. And so I think it's a glaring win. It's most demonstrated by the adoption of the technology. Everywhere the technology has been made available, large farmers and small farmers have adopted it globally.
Okay.
For they've adopted it for cotton, corn, soybeans, canola, and continues to grow, with a lot of the growth and adoption now being smallholder farmers in the third world.
Well, Roy, I really appreciate you being here today. Thank you so much for stopping by. This is Dave Cornelison signing off for the webcast version of STEM Spots.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.